afraid it's come down to that time. It's the last talk of the day again already. I don't know where the time goes, but anyway. I'm glad to say that we're welcoming our next speaker back. Janet Drew talked to us some years ago. Janet started her career with a PhD at University College London, and then spent 12 years at Imperial College, followed by 8 years at Oxford, before she moved to her present institution, which is the University of Hertfordshire. She's director of the Centre of Astrophysics Research, a group that contains more than 60 staff, postgraduate researchers and graduate students. Professor Drew is also principal investigator of 2 photometric surveys of the Milky Way. It's good to welcome her back to the annual meeting, and the title of her talk is Massive Stars Across the Milky Way Disk from Optical Surveys. Janet. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm really pleased to be back, actually. It was 7 years ago when I last came here. It was winter as well, actually. It wasn't all sunshine outside, as I remember, when that particular annual meeting was held. And I'm really pleased to learn that actually the society seems to be growing, which is always a really good sign. Now then, I'm aware that this is the last talk of the day. The title and actually the contents of the slides is possibly a bit more ambitious than maybe the end of the day warrants. So I'm probably going to skip a chunk in the middle. If any of you are desperately interested in galactic disk kinematics and rotation of a galactic disk, I'm happy to tell anybody afterwards about that, so to speak, because I do have some slides on that subject. I think I'm going to cut them out, so that you can get away at a reasonable time, not fall asleep, and that sort of thing. Actually, what light level are we on at the moment? Are we back on the 50%? Because I think we might want to drop to the 25. Mm-hmm. That's off. Yes. Do I ping this thing and it'll wake up? Yeah. Ooh. Maybe we are on 25. So I'm just dark adapted.
Yes, that's 20. Yeah.
I think you've still got the lights off, though.
Yeah.
Do you want to switch? No, I think you probably have to switch it to the wall or something, don't you?
Well, you think that was 25%?
That doesn't look like 25%, does it?
That's off, so yeah, that's 25.
I know, that's the trouble. I'm just trying
to... No, I'm afraid that's
it. That's it, yes, that's it. Yeah, that's right. Okay, enough for you to see where you're sitting, but also to help the screen a bit as time goes on. Right, I'll be running around like a mad thing a bit because I'm going to have to hand change the slides and all the rest of the technology is working, but not that. I didn't bring a thing of me. So, what am I actually going to do then? I'm actually missing out item one in the middle there, I think. But I'm going to give you, probably in the first 20 minutes or so, I'm going to give you an overview of the surveys that have actually dominated my life. But it's now about 15 years, actually, so it's been a long time. So I'll go through those first, and then spend quite a lot of time, which sort of illustrates the way that the surveys can be exploited, and a nice feature about the particular application I will tell you about is that it connects us into the Gaia era as well, in that it's actually about material that's just been submitted as a paper that makes use of proper motion data from Gaia DR2. So without further ado, let me get stuck in. Also, if my voice drops a bit, please wave or something if you can't hear me. Right, first of all, let me introduce you to the surveys. So they kind of live underneath an acronym, EGAPS, which stands for European Galactic Plane Surveys. Slight cheating acronym there, but never mind. And it's built up from 3 surveys, really. There are 2 northern surveys. One's called IFAS, and it was the first one to start. The second one is called UVEX, and the last one to start is the southern survey, VFAS Plus. Now, the way it works is that essentially IFAS, as a survey, which began in 2003, takes on board 3 filters. Spanning the entire galactic plane. We observe in the R-band, the I-band, and H-alpha narrow band. And the name IFACS actually stands for INTWFCE, Photometric H-Alpha Survey of the Northern Galactic Plane. So those are the distinctive features of IFAS. It was joined about three years after the start of IFAS by UVEX, which is a blue complementary survey covering the same galactic plane fields as IFAS, but picking off the U filter, the G, and the R again. That was with the idea that in time we might be able to use proper motion information between UVEX and IFAS in the two R-band epochs. Also included a narrowband helium-1 filter, which is in this picture for historic purposes. It proved not to be terribly useful, so it's actually withered on the vine a little bit. These two cover the northern plane. VFAS Plus does the whole lot, excepting this narrowband helium-1 line in the southern plane. And you can see the whole thing is stuck on top of the spectrum of Vega, and you can see obviously the U band, which is the shortest band, picks out the very light around the Balmer continuum, and is very sensitive for hot stars. The H alpha filter, of course, is there to pick out emission line objects as much as anything. Right. Okay. I need to name the people involved. We have been a kind of multinational consortium. Locally, Mike Irwin has been a very important component of the survey, because he's been running the pipeline that does all the data reduction. And the other people spread across Europe and a few in the United States. We've got someone in Hong Kong now. But of the individuals who have actually made big contributions, I particularly want to draw attention to Robert Grimel, who's in Graz, because he's been the man that's always done the populating of the observing lists and looking after data transfers and sort of moving stuff around. Been very, very important. And all these other names at the bottom, a lot of them are actually PhD students. So it has been the stuff of several PhD projects over the years. Right. Not Nick Walton, as one example in that list. He's local in Cambridge here. Right. Characteristics of the surveys, just to give you an idea of what we're doing. Right, so we do all of the galactic plane within the latitude range, plus or minus B. Okay. We are in the south doing more around the galactic centre in order to capture the inner parts of the galactic bulge. So it goes out to plus or minus 10. Near the galactic centre. Across the sky, we're pretty much all the time reaching around about 20th magnitude. And in fact, much of the time we start saturating around about 12th magnitude or so. It's really weird in a way. When we started these surveys, we used to get, if you don't jiggle this often enough, thank you. When we started the surveys, I remember it being commented by some people on review panels, oh, this survey's a bit bright, isn't it? Well, that's kind of weird now, because here we are, the recent Gaia data release sort of proves we're actually, if anything, a bit faint. We could have done with actually having sensitivity up to about 9/10 or thereabouts, because the overlap then with Gaia actually would have been better, as it happens. So anyway, can't always believe what review panels say is the sort of the moral of that story. Is there any way of actually improving the dwell time here? What's going on? Right. Okay, so the northern surveys have been, the data taking has all been done at the Isaac Newton Telescope in La Palma, which is a great telescope these days. It's mostly run by students now, and so it's a brilliant training telescope in professional terms, but it's been a wonderful experience using it, actually. It's great fun because you get to, you throw it around yourself and so on. It's not a case of being kept away from the instrument. You actually get involved with all aspects. In the south, it's running on the BLT survey telescope, which in extreme contrast I have never been to. I have never even stepped inside the control room in that case, in that it's run as a public survey. It's run in a very bureaucratic sort of fashion, actually. There's complete contrast to the northern surveys. The basic underlying principle to what we do, the way we observe, is that we obtain the different colours or the different filters simultaneously on any given location in the sky. Well, not simultaneously, contemporaneously. In other words, when we go to a position in the sky, in say, for instance, an IFAS pointing, we'll go to the R band, the I band, and the H alpha band in quick succession. And we do the same in the blue with U, G, and R. The reason being that if you do this, and given that stars are variable, you know, we all know that stars are variable, by doing it like that, you're actually capturing a fair sort of picture of the instantaneous SED, if you like, spectral energy distribution of those stars. Now, you don't get sort of funny effects because you've taken the R band 1 month and the H alpha a year later or something like that. So, in a sense, we're trying to respect the way in which we know that stars will vary. What this slide, oh, it does say this slide. So the spatial resolution that's our norm is around about 1 arcsecond. And so it means we've got it's a huge data volume, because after all, the whole survey is of order, over 3,600 square degrees. So it's vast quantities of data. And indeed, the recent releases for IFAS have had 200 million objects in them. Right, so what's it all for? Well, it's high-resolution photometric imaging. I've just said that, really. We started out, really, planning on a massive update of H-alpha emission line objects, which was sort of the motivation behind the original set of IFAS filters. But we've grown in ambition since. Through the addition of the blue filters, we're well-placed to actually bring out the UV excess population, which sort of brings out another group of essentially evolved, you know, rare evolved objects. Because the nature of stars is such that they're more likely to be emission line objects late in their life, and they will pass through and become things like white dwarfs and so on, which also come with blue excesses and so on. So in a way, this whole set of surveys is a machine to find sort of fleeting phases of stellar evolution. One thing we've discovered we can do rather well with the data is that you can use the multiband information to do a rather good job on mapping dust extinction across the galactic plane and doing that in a three-dimensional sense, using the large numbers of stars with estimated distances and their extinctions, sort of to build up a picture of how dust is distributed through the galactic plane. And because we're a very wide area survey, you're no longer kind of sort of biased towards taking a telescope, pointing at something like a cluster, and only looking at the cluster and ignoring its environment. That's been the history in star cluster studies. We now... Why does it flash on and off?
I'm not sure. That's correct. We could put it on the other machine if you wanted to.
No.
Because it gets really bad.
Yes, okay. I was wondering whether it's just as, you know, it's a bit like, you know, these motion sensors, whether I'm not jumping around enough or something. Anyway, right, so yes, a feature of these surveys is that it allows you to kind of step away from being a bit sort of tunnel vision in terms of the parts of the galactic plane that you look at. You can sort of see the wide environmental setting as well as the sort of detail. And finally, a very practical point, it is turning into a fabulous resource for target selection for the next generation of the multi-object spectrographs, which, you know, the new spectrographs being built can get, you know, 1,000 spectra over a square degree. And you've got to be able to feed those sorts of beasts with targets. And these sorts of surveys provide the targets. what I'm going to talk about is mostly about these last two. So when I come on to the science, it's really about these last two items in the list. Right. Okay. This is just a quick status update on where the surveys are in terms of their execution. I guess I'm pleased to say we're kind of finished. It only took us about 14 years to do it all, but we have finished. We did release already a publicly accessible catalogue back in 2014, which did 95% of the plane, pretty much. It's always that last few percent that put you through pain and agony. But we think we're pretty much there, and we're in the process of building what essentially should be a final catalogue. UBEX, which as I said started a bit later than IFAS, still not quite complete. It still needs some more repeat observations actually to be done to deal with bad weather. And it's the case with the Galactic Plane Survey. A part of the plane is in a part of the year for observing when the weather is good. And another part is in the part of the year when the weather is deleted expletive. Right. I mean, yeah. Winter in the Palmer can be a real pig at times. And it's the winter bits that we're still trying to polish up. But we're planning on including some of the UVEX filters into the next IFAS data release to bring them all together, because that will increase the power of what you can do. And the Southern Survey has actually gone much more slowly than the original plan said it would, which was about a 3-year or 4-year plan. We started in 2011. It's not finished yet. Next slide, I shall show you where we got to in the south. That's the status for the south. You're looking at the entire footprint, essentially, for the survey there. The pinky-looking squares, which... let's see. This was working earlier. Am I blind? Can anybody see a red point? Hold on, let's try the other one.
I'll tell you why it doesn't work. Nothing needs to be taken.
Oh, yes, thank you. Right, yeah, so the pink ones here, they are waiting to be done, although actually we're probably never going to do these because we want to finish off in the next 6 months to a year, if we can. But we're definitely going to be finishing up all of this stuff up here. This is the Galactic Centre region, of course. That's the expanded region around the bulge that you can see there. And you're actually seeing the southern winter effect here, in that, of course, the weather in sort of June down in Chile is not great. So there's been slow progress in this part of the plain. And you can see it's sort of a kind of patchwork at the moment, in terms of in some places the blue filters have been done and some red filters have been done and so on. Already about 43% of the footprint is available through releases that ESO likes to manage. Okay. And just to say something about how these bands work together, the plot at the top, which is actually based on VFAS Plus data, shows you source counts, I numbers of sources you detect in a field as a function, was a cumulative diagram, so you can sort of see what's typical for the different filters. The U band, way down at the bottom end of the optical range, into sort of the ultraviolet, when you look at those filters, it looks like there's no light going through them at all. I mean, the transmission through these filters is really quite low. And so, of course, the source counts in the U-band are way down compared to what you get in the G, R, and I bands. And that's what's visible in that top plot there. In that you can see that, 50% of fields have got source counts of at least what would be about 30,000 or so per square degree in the U-band. But whereas if you go all the way up to I here, you're talking about 200,000 per square degree. That's both about the filter transmission and it's about reddening, extinction. in the galactic plane. So extinction is a very big factor, obviously, if you're surveying the galactic plane. And we've always approached it with the philosophy that we are trying to count as much as possible in G, R, and I bands. So we set up our exposure times to try and bring those source counts close together. But with U, we don't ever expect to count anything like as many sources per square degree. And instead, the U band is set up to be sensitive to picking up UV excess objects. So in other words, it picks up hot dwarfs, white dwarfs, it picks up massive OB stars, those sorts of things. But a lot of stuff does not get detected in the U-band. Bottom here actually shows you what magnitude limits are like in the different images. And you can see again about a half of all exposures in the HR and I bands reaches down to nearly 21st magnitude. U-band, actually, the formal calibration of the data is lying a bit. It should really, this curve ought to be up here a bit. But it's still getting down below 21st magnitude. And the most sensitive band in VPS Plus actually is this one, getting down to 22 and more. Right. And this is an example of what kind of data you can get. This is just an image. And it's about 3 by 6 arc minute area. It's in the galactic bulge. And what's being done, actually, what Geert did, who built it, was he actually combined in the blue colour U and G, and in the green it's G and R, and in the red it's R and I. And so you kind of get this false colour image here. And the longer you spend looking at this, the more you realise that there's this huge substrate of stars sitting beneath these very obvious objects here. So, you know, these are actually deeply impressive images that are coming particularly from the galactic bulge. And it's testament to the BLT Survey Telescope. It does have phenomenal sort of image control and seeing quite a lot of the time. And you know, the typical seeing is indeed 0.8 arc seconds in the survey in the G-band, for instance. And I have to say, I mean, you know, the data is stupendous, actually. One of the sad features of the VLT survey telescope is that it took an awfully long time for it to actually see first light. You know, it's the most accident-prone telescope ever. I think they went through 2 primary mirrors before the final configuration. I think one of them got smothered in sea salt or something like that as it was being shipped, and I think another time it just broke or something. Anyway, so it was, in some ways one feels that this telescope needed to be working probably 5 years earlier than it actually was, but you know, it is a really fine imager. Right. Actually, I was thinking whether to pause and ask the questions now on the basic surveys before I plunge into a piece of science. Is that too irregular? Or is that...
you do it how you want to do it.
Yeah, well, wait. Does anybody want to ask anything now before I carry on?
Do you use atmospheric dispersion characters?
No. Certainly not with the IMT, because we do stay to fairly low air mass, so we stay below 1.4, as typical. I mean, there is an issue with the VST. I think it does have some degree of correction. To be honest, I'm actually not completely sure about this. Yeah, it must do. It does. But nevertheless, it's not perfect. And in the U, if you look really closely, the image quality is not as good as it is in G, R, and I. They struggle more to keep the images circular rather than a wee bit stretched out. So,
but it's pretty darn good, I have to say. Also, the VST is actually being used for a very deep extragalactic survey where they're trying to measure the kind of distortions associated with weak lensing. So they care desperately
about the image quality and the way in which the instrument, Omegacam, has been built, has been to do that science. So if you like, the image quality was always a big consideration in the way the instrument was constructed. Yes?
Just on a practical side, really, yeah. You mentioned the winter was pretty bad on the Palmer.
Yeah.
I'm visiting the observer shop there. And
yes.
The
you probably went in the summer, though, didn't you?
I go in the summer a lot. Yeah, yes. I go in the autumn and the spring as well, but never the winter.
No.
And she said there's 320 clear nights a year for the observatories, which implies there's 45 bad ones. Presumably they're all in the winter then, aren't they?
All observatories are very good at their PR about
winter. She did say it was the best scene, though, of the three main sites.
The winter is funny. Obviously, if you get a good night in the winter, it's great because the nights are so long. But I kid you, we've got very good weather statistics, sort of built over about a decade, on just what happens between the sort of summer, autumn, and into the winter. And I can tell you that we've been through winters in which we only got about 10-20% of the allocated time producing usable data.
I've seen vehicles all covered in thick ice.
Exactly. Well, that certainly happens too. But actually, in the winter, it is much more subject to sort of invasions from varying air masses and such like, and conditions change really fairly quickly.
But doing a survey like this, can you get data when there's a bit of moon up in the sky?
Yes. Yes, we do actually. Well, for the blue bands, we work in a darker sky. But for IFAS, we do use... we started out, actually, it's an interesting story. We did start out trying to use bright time, but we kind of gradually backed off now. So we avoid the brightest time. And the main reason for that is the H-alpha narrow band. Because with the H-alpha narrow band, if you've got moonlight in there, it's very hard to separate that from genuine diffuse H-alpha emission. So in fact, and we've seen this through trying to build mosaic images, if you've got quite dramatically different moon levels, it becomes a real pick. Trying to get them to stitch together and to be sure of what is diffuse H-alpha emission and what is moonlight. I mean, I still have back in my mind a plan to do something much more careful with the way we deal with trying to actually extract the moonlight. We can do it, because again, the simultaneous R, I, and H alpha.
Because then it gives you more time, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can use the R and the I to tell you about the moon. So, yes.
The Palmer's telescopes were older than the VLT.
Yeah.
Is it comparable in its capacity?
No, it's not as good, by any means. Certainly the field, because actually, there's a huge difference between the two cameras, actually. Because the wide field camera on the INT is just four CCDs, which they lashed together very quickly. It was not a grand project like the Omegacam instrument for the VST, as it happens. And there's even a lovely little thing in the control room, which is like a little Keith Robinson reconstruction of what the image plane of that camera looks like. And it's got all the slopes of the CCDs, but they're not completely flat, for instance. So, you know, it's a much more rough and ready, so it doesn't get the same quality of seeing anyway. So in some senses, it doesn't matter too much. I mean, the northern seeing tends to be, I said 0.8 for the BST, which is true. We're getting more like 1.1, 1.2 in the data we're prepared to accept.
And the BST can generate these four stars?
It doesn't do that, but they do actually have a degree of, they do actually deform the mirror a bit. It does have actuators to actually change the mirror shape. They're not using lasers or anything like that. Not that level. But they do try and collect enough light and figure out and slightly change the mirror shape. They do that sort of thing. Right, I'll go on to the next section now. So we'll talk about a bit of science, which will just illustrate how we use these data. Right, this is the bit I'm going to skip, so shut your eyes. And I shall just pile through a few slides here. Right, there we go. Right, so this is the second section. Now then, and this does link to the title of the talk, actually. So now I want to talk about, actually, BFAS plus data again, and using the discrimination that the U-band gives you to pull out massive stars across the southern plain. So, What's this about? Why do we care about massive OB stars? Well, for starters, the massive OB stars, you know, things that live only for about 5 million years or something like that, but you know, their luminosities are enormous, the amount of UV light that they kind of spray across a galactic environment, as well as the winds and the chemical enrichment they are responsible for, they're very important, even if they're short-lived. And of course, they're the sort of primary markers for spiral arms. So we want to know where they are, because effectively they're shaping their environments. So they're important objects to know about. And another feature they have, because they're so luminous, and on average relatively distant, they turn out to be these wonderful kind of like torch beams, along which you can sample, for instance, what the interstellar medium is up to, and pick up the interstellar medium in absorption along those sidelines. So they're great, actually, to being able to get at the structure of the interstellar medium as well. And there is this real nagging issue that effectively much of what we know about massive star evolution is still oddly embryonic, and we certainly don't know where they form. Or should we say, we do know where they form, but we're not sure about all the features of where they form and whether there are other possibilities or not. So it's a wee bit chaotic, in fact. So, what we can do with EGAPs, I mean, there's a little list at the bottom in terms of the features we can use to actually get at these guys. And in this bit, it's the bottom one that I'm mostly talking about. It's using blue excess to actually find the non-emission O to B3 stars, which are the kind of your average massive star in some sense. Right, how do we do it? We use a photometric diagram. So this is a two-colour diagram here. Got U minus G going up on the left axis and G minus R on the horizontal axis. And essentially what you're doing is you plot everything that you observe in the field on one of these diagrams. The O and B stars live at the top, basically, and they're quite nicely separated for spectral types earlier than B3. And this is because their spectral energy distributions are essentially very close to what's called the Rayleigh-Jeans limit, which makes them very simple but relatively blue intrinsically. Okay, and so you can do an easy job with one of these diagrams to just skim off all the guys sitting at the top. You can use these sorts of tracks, which you can compute quite easily, and say, right, I expect everything above this line to be a B3 star or earlier. So the selection is really easy. And you don't get this power if you do not have the U band, basically. If you just rely on G, it's not enough of a discriminant. Okay, so this is actually a diagram for around a young cluster Westland 2, which I want to talk about in the closing slides of this section. Right, so what we've done, this is really a PhD project I'm describing now, is we took a chunk of fields which had been observed fairly early in the survey and decided we would do a kind of search in the region of... When I move, it does seem to change. Yeah, so we decided to pick out this chunk and we went for the Carina Arm, which is in the Southern Plain, and this diagram shows you why we might go for the Carina Arm. Because there's the Sun on a sort of plan map of the galaxy with a rough diagram of where the spiral arms are located. And you can see that the Carina Arm is lying in this region here, sort of roughly tangentially organised. So it means you get an awful lot of star forming volume for a fairly narrow spread on the sky. Okay. So we decided to concentrate on this area, and Mike, whose thesis this was sent off to do the task of doing the blue selection by the means I just showed you. But then, I'll explain in a moment, you've got to follow that up in order to actually improve the selection. But the way this has gone, we started out kind of validating our methods. There's been a couple of publications on that. And what I'm going to show you now is a small focused-in analysis of just one cluster in its environment to show you what we can do. Okay, So, how does this work, roughly speaking? What you do, you select, and that's the first step, which I've already spoken about, using this UMICE UMICE-R diagram. But then, this is the important bit, because the diagram you've selected from, of course, has stars of very many different extinctions. So the region is actually smeared by extinction. So what we do is we actually use our broadband data and supplement it with near-infrared magnitudes from two mass, mostly, in order to actually take each star and fit its magnitudes to a reddened spectral energy distribution of a whole library of atmosphere templates. Okay. And from that, what you get out is actually a very precise measure of the extinction, you know, how reddened the object is, and a rough idea of how hot it is. Okay. So, in effect, it tells you the extinction, and it tells you whether you're dealing with a very hot O star or with a sort of cooler O star or perhaps an early B star. It gives you that kind of discrimination. So, and this is the result of it. Now, here's a little movie for you. It's worth spending some time. It'll keep cycling through. This is what he found. Thank you. Across an area of 42 degrees. It's an irregular shape because we took what was available at the time in the Korean region. Underneath is actually just an H-alpha mosaic constructed from the data. You can see the Carina Nebula in the middle, famous object, of course. And what you're seeing in the little spots and triangles that are coming up is every object that we found through this method we've got a good fit on, essentially. And there's about 8,000 O and early B stars being plotted here. Now, what has also been done is that every point has been coloured up according to its extinction. How much dust is reddening the spectrum. And what you see is when, wait for the bar perhaps to get back to the bottom, which will be kind of negligible reddening, is that as you go from negligible reddening to high reddening, you see the width of the band do this, right? And what that's about, of course, it's about distance. Right, because the more highly reddened stars, further away, O and B stars live in a layer that's only about plus or minus 30 parsecs thick. And it carries on being like that. So obviously, if you're seeing more distant objects, they're going to occupy a narrower band. Right, and so this movie rather nicely illustrates that, because as it scans up towards the top end, you do see this kind of drop. So you see, reddening serves as kind of proxy for distance. That's the sort of point that comes out of this. And we've been exploiting that. Okay, there's another movie in this next one. It's just the O stars this time, many fewer objects. Same sort of idea, but you'll notice now that the O stars are nowhere near as uniformly distributed across the region. I should say, by the way, we're not at all sensitive to anything that's closer than 2 kiloparsecs. 6,000 light years, if you prefer. The region I'm going to talk about now is Western 2, which is at the right-hand end there and is marked. NGC 3603, very famous cluster, very brilliant. You'll notice there's a huge number of O stars associated with that. Westland 2 is a bit sparser. It's actually closer to the genuine tangent and Carina R, as it happens. But anyway, there we are. So we're going to talk about Westland 2 now. Right, so it's a very massive young cluster, Westland 2. It's in a fairly quiet part of the Carina R, which helps. It makes it a rather nice lab rat for understanding what young massive star clusters are like and what they do, because it's not confused by other stuff around it too much. And we noticed that there was a scatter of O stars around the cluster, but not in it. And we were interested to know whether there's any connection between those O stars and the cluster itself. So that was where we were going with this. And in particular, we're aware that there's a phenomenon known as the runaway star. Have any of you heard of runaway stars? Let me do a quick show of hands. Just want to know. Oh, good. Excellent. Right. Okay, just for those who don't know, a runaway star is an object that's found moving very fast in the galactic plane and oftentimes can actually be traced back to a particular location of formation, and they tend to be O stars very often. Okay. And indeed, they've been around for long enough that there's a classification scheme here. To be called a runaway star, you need to have a relative motion of about 30 kilometers per second. If you're moving more slowly than that, you don't qualify. It's a bit arbitrary. And what's of interest is whether or not the field can be populated just by the runaway phenomenon, or whether you require massive stars to actually be able to form in fairly low density environments away from dense clusters. This is the sort of very uncertain issue at the moment. We don't really know whether it's possible. So in a sense, what we have to do with field O stars is trying to understand how many of them are runaways and how many of them might just have been born where they are, so as to be able to disentangle these things. So that's kind of the game we're in here. And some interesting recent results that relate to that is that there was work done in 2016, or published in 2016, on a small Magellanic cloud, which argued that you could divide the field of stars into about one third being runaways and the rest looking like they were probably formed more or less in situ. A slight problem with the small Magellanic cloud, of course, is about 50 kiloparsecs away. So there's a limit to what we can do with that sample. More recently, it's been shown that the most extreme sort of objects in the massive series, dwarf Ray stars, actually are surprisingly well dispersed, in fact, and not actually in dense clusters, which is where you might think they would prefer to be. So if you like, the cat is wandering amongst the pigeons as far as, you know, trying to understand really what goes on with O star formation. Okay, so here's Westland 2. Here is our lovely NASA-produced and touched-up. Look at those beautiful diffraction spikes on the cluster. So this is a small, the cluster itself, it actually seems to be almost in two bits, a northern bit and a southern bit. The southern bit is much bigger, brighter, and more full of stars. And it's got an H2 region around it, and you can see some of it shining nicely in the bottom left corner there. So that's just 2 by 3 arc minutes squared. Our region is 1.5 by 1.5 squared feet. So we're looking at an environment that spans about 250 parsecs side to side around this cluster. And from Mike's database of O stars, the objects plotted in here are what we pulled out from that database. They have actually been selected in the sense that we don't look at anything that has an extinction less than 5.5 magnitudes. The reason being that we think to get to the neighbourhood of Westland 2, you need to have that amount of extinction, obviously. So everything in blue on this diagram has an extinction between 5.5 and 7.5 magnitudes, and everything that's red on this diagram is 7.5 or even more reddening. The most reddened object is actually Wolf Rayet star 20C, which has got an extinction of just over 10 magnitudes. Okay. So these are our animals that we want to know about. And what we have done since sort of starting to look at this area, we've got spectra of the two guys which are in boxes, both are in blue, objects just happen to carry the labels 1273 and 1338. Right. Okay, so that's where we start. So the spectra of those two objects, taken with the VLT and X-shooter, essentially confirm what we had thought already from some less good spectra, but those two stars are really massive, very hot. O4 stars. There are not many O4 stars in the sky, actually, lots of them. And that means that their effective temperatures are up in the 40,000s or so. And from further, just kind of working the numbers through, we think that they're probably all about 50 solar masses in terms of the mass of these objects. And yet, they're 11 and 22 arc minutes away from the main cluster. So these are pretty beefy animals out there. And from the spectra, we can measure radial velocities. And we can see that one of them already essentially qualifies as a runaway star, because it has a blue shift towards of minus 29 kilometers per second. Now, what's become possible with the arrival of Gaia DL2 is to bring in proper motion data, which is very interesting. And here is the picture that comes out of the proper motions. So what I've done here, our entire search list, which was 40 stars, I pushed them through Gaia DL2 list to get out their proper motions. I've also worked out the mean proper motion of the cluster itself, which is also interesting in itself. And it both doesn't tell us the distance to the cluster. That's a frustration, a story of frustration, which I won't go into. But anyway, you can work out the relative proper motions of all the stars relative to the cluster very nicely and easily. And this is what you get, basically. So it's the same objects plotted all over again, but now the objects in red are just the ones that look like they can have been ejected from Westerlo 2. And the big surprise here is that there are so many, actually. And in the history of subject, people do not look actually on this smallish scale. So in a way, I was quite shocked when this diagram, but actually put the numbers through and produced the diagram and thought, whoa, this is really quite impressive. Yes, okay. Actually, what rather spoilt the story was we didn't put in WR21A to start with because it was too bright to be in our selection, actually, so it's an added object as it happens. And it was frustrating, kind of annoying when it went in, because it's about the only one that doesn't actually want to move on the north-south axis, more or less, actually. And that was a surprise, too. Furthermore, from the information we now have, we know that these stars will have been ejected in the last million years. Okay, you can work that out just from the numbers that come out of this. So what this all means, actually, in the end, is that A, we're finding many more of these things than we expected, because models actually suggest you should only expect to get about half a dozen, something like that, out of a cluster like this. That corresponds to an efficiency of around 10%. We've got an efficiency here of around 25%. And we probably haven't finished finding these things, actually. This is a first look. And one of the... this is kind of a whole bunch of words which sort of summarises what that picture more or less tells us. Essentially, we've got 12 of them now. And they're all kind of qualifying from what we can see in the data as runaways. And because of this north-south preference, we think we're seeing something to do with the history of the way in which this cluster formed. I mentioned when I showed you the NASA picture that there's a southern cluster and a bit of a northern cluster. There is an idea that clusters might be helped to become very dense by subcluster merging. And it has been suggested in the literature in the past, Westerlo 2, that there may have been a recent merger, and that might explain the sort of little northern knot in addition to the kind of main southern cluster. Proper motion data seems to suggest that might be a fruitful avenue to be thinking about. So the core idea that is normally advanced to explain why you eject stars from clusters is you get close dynamical interactions between a massive binary and other stars in the cluster core. And massive stars tend to segregate into the core. That mechanism on its own will not do. We do need to find other ways to eject, and perhaps subcluster merging would do it. Remains to be seen. This is a sort of very fresh, fresh result. But going back to the figure, we do have another number of objects which are sort of like this guy down here, that one there, a couple over here, a couple up there, which aren't doing very much, having a very quiet time, possibly in situ formation examples. So, you know, we're getting a division here between runaways and ones that are not. And an interesting byproduct is that we think we've identified a background OB association behind Western 2, essentially. And that's what this kind of cluster of activity, they're all quite highly reddened, in fact, but they don't really know anything at all about Western 2, so they're nothing to do with it. Right, so that's just a worked example in a small region. And the next thing to try is NGC 3603. And left is one of these kind of typical NASA images of NGC 3603. So again, you're looking at a few square arc minutes in that image. Here's what's waiting for us on the database to sort of do the same thing that we've done Western 2 for NGC 3603. And essentially, kind of going to be interested in everything pretty much that's inside that big green circle. And instead of having 40 stars, I think we're going to be looking at more like 200 to 300 of these objects. And again, we'll use population data together with the selection based on extinction to actually sort out what's going on. So, concluding remarks on the basis of that. Obviously, I've told you about EGAPS and the different surveys and the fact that we do this one arc second imaging. And I think, in a sense, the value of it in the sort of general world of kind of wider astronomy research is the way it opens up large sky areas. And you can choose any sky area, actually. That's the value of wide surveys. You know, you don't have to pre-think what you're going to look at. You've got it all, in some senses. So that has always been the ambition with these, is that they were provide this capability to go in and pick anything, pick any kind of galactic plane science that you want to pursue. And the example of Westland 2 just proves you've got a search list sitting waiting to go into the Gaia database. You can immediately pull out lots of interesting goodies. And Westland 2 is an illustration of that. And they do complement the near-infrared and long wavelength surveys, which now all exist, really. The galactic plane. So in a way, we're behind them. It's already been done in the near infrared and radio and long space infrared, you know, 100 microns and so on. So I'll end there, and I think that was enough. I think the middle section was done. It needed to be cut.
Thank you very much indeed, Janice. Good of you to come and talk to us. Any questions? Yes.
I was wondering, could you put the slide back up to the where you could see the surveys and get them all written down?
So right, okay, sure. Take me a while just to page back, but yeah, it'll be fine. You want? We'll get through all this. Nearly there. Yeah, that one.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I'll leave that there. Okay, right. Yeah. Sure.
Yes.
I'm not sure I caught the significant whether you saw there was a significance in the north-south orientation of the scatter.
Well, there's evidence. Well, the fact that the cluster itself is split north-south as well, so it's in, there has been mutterings in the literature about subcluster merger actually being responsible for building this relatively brilliant, massive young cluster. And if you see two clumps, the implication probably is that's an axis on which the merging has taken place. So what we have now, in addition to just that basic fact, is this spray of objects, kind of north and south, being kicked out of the cluster.
And if you just think of this in terms of a bit like Newton's second law, the one about momentum and so on, essentially, it's telling you there's something special about that direction. And the obvious special thing to think of is, if you like, the major collision that might have taken place that led to the merging was in that direction. That's the basic point there.
Sort of leading on a bit from that. If you've got a cluster forming, and for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, stellar winds and or movement of the cluster or what have you, and then you maybe get another cluster form, you know, further down the pipe, let's call it, right? Yeah. Now, in the case that westward, like you say, north and south, right? Yeah. Presumably, one of the clusters is younger than the other. One half of it is younger than the other.
Oh, well, so that's a complicated question.
Is it two clusters at the point I'm getting?
Sorry?
Is it two clusters, really? No,
I think the way to think of it, I don't know if you've seen some of these movies, of, like galaxy mergers, really, where you actually get two groups of stars that sort of come in and they start to do all this kind of stuff, and eventually they merge. It's not clear that you're looking at entities now that necessarily directly map onto the entities that started out in the whole process. Because, you know, a lot of messy dynamics has taken place.
Right. Because what was then going to lead on to, you see, right, was the fact that, okay, whether there is or there isn't an age difference in, and maybe they are two clusters that have merged in, or what have you, right? But presumably you could have had fast runaways from a previous epoch.
All right. I mean,
so
you're getting on to a point.
Stars, the short-lived stars, aren't they? So, to some extent, they're going to burn out once they get, you know, so far.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Given 3 to 5 million years in UXC.
Yeah, how far would they travel in that time?
Well, there you're seeing, because the, as I said, all of those stars that you can see in that image have left Western 2 in the last 1 million years.
Yeah.
The clusters are the oldest ages that people have tried to pin on objects in the cluster isn't much older than that.
Right. Is it a way of dating clusters?
Well, I think the interesting thing here is that because it's so hard to pin ages on massive stars, because as I said at the beginning, with the evolution of massive stars, you know, I think some people overbelieve the existing models, but you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in there, and it is really quite hard to look at an ensemble and say star X is older than star Y when we're all very young and massive. So that's a bit of a problem. But it's certainly true, and this is one of the interesting features of everything having left in the last million years. It's going to have to be a bit older than that. And that in itself, I mean, the whole, should we say, there are Wolf Rayet stars. Wolf Rayet stars struggle to be less than about 1.5 million years old, I think. So it does mean, it looks like there was, if you like, there is a prior life in the system beyond what you can actually see now. So it's helping to pull it open. Without the dynamics, it's actually hard to see it.
That's, I see what you're getting at. So in other words, we've got to understand the stellar evolution to sort of answer some of the questions.
Or vice versa. Or we vice actually versa. Might find that the dynamics is easier to do in some ways than the stellar evolution.
Well, thinking of something like, say, the Pleiades, right, now, which obviously we know what's a nice, you know, sort of
got
small cluster, really.
So it's older,
But is that relatively stable then in those two?
Yeah, it's a fairly loose open sort of. It is, you know, fits the description of open cluster really quite well. This is actually denser than the average open cluster. And you see 3603 is even denser. A much bigger beast. It's not surprising, it's got a much bigger halo.
Yeah.
On
the subject of dense clusters, you look essentially at runaway stars in the plane of the sky. What if they simply run away from you? Behind the cluster or towards you?
Well, in the case of Westland 2, I think we're safe because it is about 5 to 6 kiloparsecs. So, you know, there is, you know, physically the amount of space between us and it is huge. So, any massive star, we will see them. Actually, I mean, the more subtle point is.
Well, that's one, you wouldn't necessarily, would you?
Well, actually, if you have, it's an interesting point that if you want to know about the runaway stars that are literally coming at you, if that's what your point is.
That's one of them, yes.
Yeah. You've got to take spectra.
Yeah.
Because you will not know
But if you're drilling away from it, you wouldn't even see it.
No, exactly. So you're missing some. Yeah. So when finally, when you put together statistics on the runaways around a given cluster, you will have to make corrections for those which you will have missed. So, you know, the 12 that I'm citing now is in effect a minimum. All good points.
The work you've done on these three surveys, isn't that all been done again by Gaia 2?
Oh, the number of times I hear this. No. Well, yes and no, actually, is the right answer. You bear in mind, I started this back in 2003, 2004. Gaia was launched in 2013. So, I don't know if any of you have read a wonderful book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. There's a wonderful chapter in there about what they call pre-mortems. Actually, realising what you are letting yourself in for before you start. Right? And I remember reading it and the hairs on the back of my neck going up because it really felt so true. In the sense that we thought that we might be able to get through with IFAS in about 5 or 6 years. I applied, got the application for the VST survey, went in about 2004. But the telescope didn't even exist until 2011. Right. So anyway, that's partly what was behind my remarks about the VST being a very troubled telescope. But does Gaia repeat at all? Well, it does to the extent that obviously you've got space advantage in terms of the very high spatial resolution, and you don't have Webber in the same sense. So all of those things, of course, are very important and very valuable. However, the nature of the photometry is rather different. So this is big broadband G, and also the BPRP, although they're normally they're prisms, but you know, for the most part they're going to be used as sort of broadband colours. So, and they're not good. They don't have. It doesn't have much U sensitivity. Nor, in a sense, do they have much HR sensitivity. So those particular features of these surveys, in a sense, still exist as sort of not really matched by what Gaia.
Support.
It does different things.
WR stars.
As you can see, I mean, it's useful to use one survey to plunder the other, really. And that's what's going to go on across the pitch in all sorts of ways.
But doesn't that mean that now you can do more work in the same vein with what's been produced by Gaia 2?
Yeah, so NGC 3603, as soon as I can get rid of current bits of annoyance, I'm going to be in there and pulling out the proper motions for the same objects and do the same thing all over again. Yeah, and just expand it more and more.
Can I ask with the precision of Gaia 2, whether you'd be able to detect binarity in these stars?
No, actually, at the moment, the binarity, the ability for Gaia to detect binaries, it really gradually fades away as you pass through 1 kiloparsec.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah. There's one difference, too. I mean, coming back to your question, actually, is that weirdly, most of what we do does concern 1 to about 5 kiloparsecs. And at the moment with Gaia DR2, the parallaxes are not really touching that. So actually, in a way, speaking purely personally, there's a mild disappointment in the sense that we're not actually being helped by Gaia DR2 on the distances question for a lot of the stuff that we are actually looking at. But what Gaia DR2 essentially mops up, even before you get onto DR3, is the solar neighbourhood. I out to about 501 parsecs and 1 kiloparsec. It's got pretty much everything nailed, and that would include binaries, actually. If you look at the kind of final expected performance figures, it'll still struggle with binaries, actually, beyond 1 kiloparsec, I think.
Do we know, is there current thinking on the highest viable masses of these very hot stars? Is it 100, 150?
Well, there are flames, aren't there, for some stars in the LMC, in 30 Doradus region, for about 200.
200?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's funny, when I was brought up, so to speak, in astronomy and stellar masses and what was possible and what was not.
Yeah.
Everything was pooping around about 100 solar masses.
Yes.
But at the moment, I get the feeling that the people who do the stellar structure, stellar evolution models at the high mass end are much freer and more relaxed about what they think is possible. I think partly people were a bit frightened in the past because they thought that these very massive stars would be so horribly unstable they couldn't survive long enough to be real stars in some sense. But people don't worry about that so much. And so you see things being chucked around in the literature where you've got these 200 solar mass objects that will become black holes, won't even have proper supernovae or anything like that.
Right.
So, yeah. So high mass end is a real mess, actually, in terms of evolution.
Has the survey picked up anything that is through the galaxy, i.e. extragalactic?
Oh, yes, actually. We've seen the odd quasar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to vary. It depends on where you look. Mm. And certainly as we go into the antecentre region, the antecentre was certainly seen all the way through very easily, actually. There's kind of regions, if you go in towards the galactic centre, sort of in the first and fourth quadrant, and within a strip of plus or minus one or two in latitude, in there you have no chance of seeing through. But people are too frightened of the galactic plane. It's not as dark and horrible as all that, really. Actually, you see, even in the Gaia publications, actually, the primary, Lindgren et al., which is on the astrometry. I'm more interested in the astrometry than I am anything else. There's a plot in there, which, of course, the galactic plane looks like here be dragons, zone a little bit. And that's because, of course, the quasar VLBI network, which gives the reference frame that Gaia is trying to actually, at the moment, hitch itself onto to actually check how well it is doing, it doesn't go into the galactic plane. That's because of these expectations that you don't see anything very much. Which, as I say, it's certainly true over past the plane, but it's been a bit exaggerated, is what I would say.
Well, I think we've had a very informative and very entertaining talk, and let's thank Janet again for coming.
Dodgy connection or something.
It's quite funny, really.
We haven't had any problems with this, but these things are wired through.
I wonder if it's the HDMI.
Yes, it could be that. Yeah. It could be just this.
The VGA might not have given the same trouble, for instance.
But the
do 2 minutes on lunch?
Yes, do. Yes.
Just a quick point to note is that you'll notice, maybe.